Ladies and gentlemen, please rise. This court is now in session.
Please be seated. Thank you. Will the clerk please call the next case?
320-0391, People of the State of Illinois, appellee by Miles Keller versus Chris Sanders, appellant by Rebecca Levy.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Rebecca Levy from the Office of the State Appellate Defender, arguing on behalf of Mr. Chris Sanders.
I can't hear.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Move that closer to you. And that really is for the court.
Okay.
I think it will amplify.
I'll try to speak better. There's no dispute in this case that the trial court violated Supreme Court Rule 431B when questioning the potential jurors in this case during voir dire. The issue in this case, therefore, is pretty narrow. Was counsel on direct appeal arguably ineffective for raising this undisputed issue? Not as first prong plain error, which was the only viable legal channel for pursuing the claim, but instead raising it as second prong plain error, which the Supreme Court, the Illinois Supreme Court, has affirmatively foreclosed as a meritless legal theory multiple times. Under the Post-Conviction Hearing Act, a petition is sufficient to avoid a summary dismissal, which is the posture of this case. Simply if the allegations are not frivolous or patently without merit. And Sanders has met this standard. In other words, Sanders has shown that it's at least arguable that appellate counsel's failure fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and that Sanders was prejudiced by appellate counsel's failure. That the Rule 403 violation occurred and constituted error is not a fanciful factual allegation. This court already found that the error occurred on direct appeal. So therefore, the factual basis for the claim is not fantastic or delusional. His legal claim is also not based on an indisputably meritless theory. No possible strategy supports appellate counsel's failure to raise this issue on direct appeal as first prong plain error. Counsel clearly recognized the error because he raised it, but he raised it under the wrong prong, second prong, which, as I mentioned, the Illinois Supreme Court has long held that Rule 431B violations do not constitute. It's also at least arguable that Sanders is prejudiced by appellate counsel's failure to raise this issue, where the evidence in this case was closely balanced. The issue that was contested was whether or not the incident, the sex of the, but that the defendant was alleged to have committed sexual assault, whether the actual incident was consensual, which ultimately came down to a credibility contest between EC, the alleged victim, and then the defendant Sanders. And a credibility contest between the two of them is the definition of closely balanced. The state's case rested largely on EC's mostly uncorroborated claims. She was impeached at trial by her own text messages, showing that she lied under oath. She also contradicted Sanders' testimony. And the jury clearly had questions about her credibility, which is shown by the one of several notes that it sent during deliberation when it asked to see any prior statements that EC made to the police. So clearly, the jury was looking for some sort of corroboration of her testimony. The jury also sent a note asking if it had to be unanimous, had to present a unanimous verdict on each of the four counts. Sanders doesn't deny that a reasonable juror could conclude that the sexual encounter was not consensual, but a reasonable jury could also conclude that the encounter was consensual. And that's exactly why the evidence in this case was closely balanced. Under Sebi, both sides presented plausible versions of the incident, and neither of their versions was fanciful. And none of the state's evidence provided such compelling support to EC that led victims' account of events as to alter the fundamental character of this trial as a credibility contest. And so there's no reason for counsel on direct appeal not to have raised this issue. And his failure to do so only could have prejudiced Sanders because it's at least arguable, which is all he has to show at this point, that appellate counsel's failure to raise the matter as first-pronged plain error rendered the result of his appeal unreliable or fundamentally unfair. We're asking the court to remand for second stage proceedings under the Post-Conviction Hearing Act because the claim Sanders raised in his petition is not based on either a fantastical factual allegation or a meritless legal theory. Thank you. If you have any questions.
You have time to reply.
Thanks.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Miles Kelleher on behalf of the people. May it please the court. The trial court properly dismissed defendant's post-conviction petition because it was frivolous and patently without merit. Defendant's claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel had no arguable basis in either fact or law. Now we know here that the trial court did commit a Rule 431B violation during jury selection. And we know that defendant did not object at trial. So the only way defendant could bring this claim was under the plain error doctrine. However, under the facts and circumstances of this case, defendant could not satisfy either prong of the plain error doctrine. The error did not constitute first prong plain error because the evidence in this case was not closely balanced. And on direct appeal,
we're talking about first plain error is error that's not preserved by notice. And it's in the record. This court find that was plain error, it was there in the original appeal.
Yes. Yes, this court did find that.
They determined that though it was plain error, it was not reversible.
Exactly, Your Honor. On a direct appeal, the defense argued second prong plain error, and in rejecting defendant's argument that this was second prong plain error, this court did observe that the evidence of defendant's guilt was overwhelming.
Error. Plain error is plain error. The question is whether it's reversible error. They said it's not reversible under the.
Yes, that's correct.
Prong analysis.
Right. This court found that there was a Rule 431B violation.
Which is error.
Yes.
Plain.
But, right. It was not reversible error, just to be clear.
Okay.
So the question here is whether or not appellate counsel would have been successful had he brought this claim also under the first prong of plain error on direct appeal.
Plain error analysis.
Exactly, yes, plain error analysis. And because the evidence was not closely balanced, defendant's claim under the first prong of plain error analysis would not have been successful on direct appeal. And first of all, this court found that the evidence of defendant's guilt was overwhelming. So if the evidence of defendant's guilt is overwhelming, that's another way of saying the evidence is not closely balanced. It would be impossible to have overwhelming evidence of defendant's guilt in a closely balanced case. But I want to talk a little bit about the actual evidence in this case to demonstrate why the evidence wasn't closely balanced. We had the testimony of the victim, EC, who testified in detail about how this sexual assault occurred. She testified how a defendant pushed her onto the bed, put his hand around her neck, removed her shorts, and then forcefully put his penis inside her vagina. She was terrified, she was panicking, she was crying, and on numerous occasions, defendant told her to be quiet and threatened her in various ways. One time he said he would beat her head in, another time, and I'm quoting, he would stick a broomstick up her butt. Another time he threatened to go to the closet and get his gun and shoot her.
Well, I'm revisiting the original appeal and you're getting into that. Was there a finding in the original appeal by this court that the evidence was not closely balanced?
No, there wasn't.
There wasn't in the original appeal.
In the original appeal, although the court never addressed specifically, didn't analyze it under the first prong, it did make an observation that the evidence was overwhelming, evidence of defendant's guilt.
Right.
And that's supported
but
by
they did address the second prong, which was the issue raised by appellate counsel, right?
On direct appeal, yes, and they rejected that. They found that, you know, despite the error that occurred, it wasn't of, you know, such substantial nature that it would deny the defendant a fair trial.
Just to get this cleared up, we're here because first stage dismissal on a post-conviction petition, correct?
That's correct.
And the only allegation that post-conviction petition was ineffective assistance counsel because counsel didn't raise the issue of first prong, closely balanced evidence in the argument.
That's the only issue that their defense is challenging on appeal here.
Right.
Yes. And just going back to the evidence, defendant also made the victim perform oral sex on him. She, at one point, was able to sneak a phone under the sheet and dial 911, but she was so afraid to even talk to the dispatcher that she just left the phone line open. And it was only when defendant's mother enters the room and confronts them that the assault stops. And at that point, defendant starts, you know, now he gets, not only is he threatening the victim, he's threatening his own mother. And at one point, he pushes her into a wall because she's afraid that the mother is going to call the police on him. So in addition to EC's testimony, there was a mountain of corroborating evidence. You had the testimony of the emergency room nurse, Jessica McManaman. She testified that when the victim came into the emergency room after this offense, she was tearful, she was upset. She stated that defendant had threatened her, had vaginally penetrated her, had forced her to perform oral sex, and the nurse observed there was fresh bruising and redness on the victim's hands and also on her legs. Photos were taken of those injuries and introduced at trial into evidence. In addition, the nurse performed an internal vaginal exam on the victim, and she discovered that there were tears and abrasions in two areas of the victim's vagina. And the nurse testified that the injuries she observed were consistent with a sexual assault and were consistent with the version of events that the victim had told her in the emergency room.
Did she say anything else as a conclusion?
Your Honor, she said that it is possible that these injuries could have been the result of rough sex. But that's exactly what defendant did here. I mean, he, during his violent sexual assault on her, every indication is he was engaged in rough sex with her, because he was doing all types of violent things to her, putting a pillow over her head, you know, holding her mouth with his hand. She was trying to...
The term rough sex refers to consensual sex that is rough.
Yes.
So she was not... Those two things are not the same. She was providing alternative possibilities.
That's correct. But I will point out, Your Honor, the victim did testify. There was testimony that she had had consensual sex with another individual earlier in the evening, but she did specifically state that was not rough sex. It was consensual sex. It was not rough sex at all. And also, she did testify that she did not have any of these injuries prior to the incident with defendant here. So the notion that...
Wasn't this victim shown to have lied repeatedly?
Your Honor, the there were some inconsistencies, but they were minor. They had to do with, you know, incidental.
If those inconsistencies, would you call them lies?
It depends on the circumstances. It depends on, you know, the gravity and whether they dealt with, you know, collateral matters. But the thing is, there's so much corroborating evidence to support the victim's testimony. And if I could just state a few more, there were the 911 calls. The first call, the dispatcher heard a woman crying in the background, a male voice in the background. And then the second 911 call, where the victim is actually talking, because at this point the defendant has finally left the apartment, so finally she feels safe enough that she can actually speak to the dispatcher. She's crying, she's breathing heavily. She states to the dispatcher that she had been kidnapped and forced to have sexual intercourse, and defendant had a gun, tried to kill not only her but also his mother. And then you have Dora Bradley's videotaped interview, where she testifies that, you know, when she encounters him, the victim is naked, she's afraid, she asks for help, and then defendant starts lashing out at her. Why? Because, you know, he thought that she was going to call the police on him. And during Dora Bradley's videotaped interview, and I'm quoting, she said that the defendant said, "I know you're going to call the police, so I might as well go to jail for a good goddamn reason for knocking both of you bitches out." That's what defendant told Dora Bradley. And then, in addition to all the corroborating evidence of that corroborated EC's version of events, you had other crimes evidence from witness LW about an incident where a defendant asked her to have sex. She said no. Defendant wouldn't leave her apartment, and then defendant pushed LW onto a bed, pulled up her nightgown, removed her underwear, and forced his penis into her vagina. So this was an uncharged offense, but it was introduced to show defendant's propensity to commit sex offenses. Now, the defendant, you know, came up with this version of events where, well, you know, this was all consensual, and defendant got mad because there was some dispute about money. But defendant talked to Detective Lieutenant Scully after this offense. He never mentioned anything about a dispute about money. He told Lieutenant Scully that the victim became upset because she found out it wasn't defendant's apartment. We can make a reasonable inference here that defendant concocted, this self-serving story at the time of trial because he had to try to explain his behavior to the jury. But again, this court, in determining whether the first prong of the plain error doctrine has been met, this court must make a common sense assessment of the evidence. It doesn't have to believe fanciful, factual, versions of events that simply aren't plausible. And this is exactly what happened here. This defendant's version of events is fanciful. It's not plausible. And there is also some notion that, maybe, as we've already discussed, maybe these injuries occurred earlier in the evening and not during this offense. But look at defendant's behavior during this offense. He's threatening her. He's forcing her to engage in sexual acts she doesn't want to engage in. And he threatens his own mother. He pushes his own mother. This was a violent person engaged in a violent assault. And defendants, the injuries that the victim sustained occurred during this offense by the defendant. There's no corroborating evidence that it occurred elsewhere other than defendant's own self-serving version of events.
Was there DNA testing in this case?
Yes, there was. It didn't indicate defendant DNA. However, Your Honor, defendant is not disputing he had sex with the victim here. So it
showed that she had sex with two other men, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reality is people have consensual sex with other people, but that doesn't preclude the possibility that they can be sexually assaulted several hours later. Sadly, that sometimes happens, and it happened in this case. So
what does the defendant have to show to meet the standard for first stage?
Defendant has to show that his claim is, he has to make an arguable showing of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And the reason he can't do it in this case is because he has not submitted any new evidence in this case. This isn't a case like some post-conviction petitions where the defendant submits affidavits from other witnesses, and then the evidence might have to be viewed in a different light, all the evidence. Here, the only evidence in this case is what happened at trial, and this court found it to be overwhelming.
Can I ask a question?
Nothing has happened since then.
I agree with you that this court has already reviewed the trial record and made the clear, non-ambiguous finding that the evidence of guilt is overwhelming. What is the legal impact of that? Would you characterize it as law of the case?
Yes, I would, but even if this court didn't, it still is, it's a law of the case because it's supported by the record. And nothing has changed in the 3 years since this court issued. Defendant has not submitted any new evidence that might say, hey, let's look at this in a different light now in light of these affidavits or whatever evidence. Sometimes that happens in post-conviction petitions. Not in this case. Nothing has changed here. And, Hodges, yes, the first stage is a lenient standard, yet it's not an impossible standard. And here, because the evidence was overwhelming, it's one of those cases where, counsel on direct appeal did the best he could. It's reasonable to assume he realized that because of the overwhelming evidence, I'm going to try for second prong plain error analysis. But you know, in many cases, you can't succeed under either prong, and this is one of those. And, you know, advancing this case to the second stage isn't going to make the evidence any different. It's not closely balanced, and this is a, it's based on a fanciful factual allegation that, and I'd just like to mention quickly, if I could.
Time is up.
Okay.
Can you make it very brief?
Yes. I'm sorry. The jury deliberations, you know, they were unanimous on one charge. Presumably, they had already found defendant guilty, decided his guilt on one charge, which means they would have rejected his fanciful version of events, which was uncorroborated and positively rebutted by all the other evidence in the case. So, you know, this simply cannot be considered a closely balanced case under any circumstances. Yes. For all these reasons, as well as those in our brief, the people respectfully request that this honorable court affirm the trial court's ruling dismissing defendant's post-conviction petition. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you may reply.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just very briefly, there's no requirement that a defendant present new evidence in order to in the form of an affidavit or any other form of new evidence, but in order to advance to second stage proceedings under the Post-Conviction Hearing Act. He, in this case, presented a claim that his constitutional rights were violated, which is sufficient under the Post-Conviction Hearing Act. Regarding the state's claim that the evidence at trial was overwhelming, and this court's finding on direct appeal that it was, second stage prong error does not involve a weighing of the evidence. So, that was the only issue that was argued on direct appeal. The parties didn't argue that the evidence was overwhelming. They didn't get into the strength of it at all. This court basically on its own just sort of summarily recited the evidence in the case and then stated without any analysis that it was overwhelming.
So would you call that dicta?
Kind of, yeah. There's never been a side B analysis of whether or not the evidence was close to balance in this case at all, which is a separate issue from whether or not this court, as I said, threw in into its opinion that the evidence in the case was overwhelming when it hadn't been briefed by any of the parties. And it's not a factor in second prong plain error. It's not a factor in...
No, what you said before that.
It hadn't been addressed by the parties whether the evidence was closely balanced. There was no argument by either side regarding the strength of the evidence at all. Regarding the state's claim that EC's testimony was credible and Sanders was not, that's just the state's view of the version of the events. Sanders presented an opposing view, an opposing version of what EC testified to. Certainly there was some kind of conflict or confrontation in the hall that involved the defendant's mother, him, and possibly EC, but that was after the alleged sexual assault happened. Whether or not that's related to it, whether or not the sex that the two of them had was consensual is a separate issue from the conflict they had in the hall after that. And regarding the testimony from LW that the state introduced as propensity evidence, it really just further shows that the state didn't think that E's testimony was going to be sufficient to prove its case beyond reasonable doubt because they brought in extra evidence from an uncharged crime to shore up their case. If there are no further questions, we're asking for this court to remand for second stage proceedings and the post-conviction hearing.
Thank you, counsel. questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, both for your arguments in this matter. It will be taken under advisement, which this position shall issue in the court.